Hello, everyone. My name is Jason Innes. I'm a professor at the George Brown Chef School. Today, we're presenting a podcast, the George Brown College podcast for the Center of Hospitality and Culinary Arts, and we're going to be discussing Canada's new food guide. We have some guests with us here today, and I'd just like you to take a moment to introduce yourselves.
Hi, my name is Linda Gillis, and I'm a dietitian, and I'm also a nutrition professor here at the Culinary School.
Hi, my name is Mina Shekarbani. I teach a class here at George Brown as well, and I'm a graduate of the chef school with some years in the food industry.
Hi, my name is Delia Dupre. I'm a student here at George Brown. I'm also a cook and somebody who is passionate about food and how we eat.
Hi, my name is Wendy Ma. I'm a previous graduate of George Brown College Culinary, and I now am a culinary professor in theory and practical. My main focus is reconnecting humans with food in all facets and within our food system.
Well, thank you. Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for being able to have this fantastic discussion today.
Good to be here.
And I thought we'd start the day off by just sort of talking about our initial thoughts when we saw this food guide. So who'd like to start?
I can get started. I reacted to it visually first. I think it's definitely something that's put together to be obviously and noticeably visually different than its predecessor. And I reacted to it both skeptically and optimistically on that plane, because I was educated based on the previous version of this document, and I couldn't be more struck by how strategically different it makes itself look.
Interesting. Delia?
Yeah, so I agree with you. It's very visual. You know, it's a lot different. It's a lot less cluttered than the original, than the previous food guide. And it's, I think, just a lot more easy to comprehend too. You can kind of look at it. You see right away that, you know, half of your what you're intaking should be maybe fruits and vegetables, you know, and it tells you to eat protein foods rather than meat and alternatives. And also, instead of telling you to eat grains, it says choose whole grains. So it's sort of, it's a lot different, and I really liked it. I thought they did a good job.
Okay, interesting. I know you said originally you liked it, so we're gonna come back to that.
Hold tight.
I was gonna actually jump off on that originally idea as well. I was excited about the visual, just like everybody else was, but then, like everything else, I like to pull things apart and put them back together. And so, upon my first application towards this puzzle, I started finding more things and I had a little bit more questions. I am very optimistic, like Mina says, about the changes that have been made, but I do have a lot of questions, and I would like to focus not actually on the visuals anymore, but on the words that have been added to this food guide and how many people may not be reading it.
Interesting. Yeah, so what you're not quite what you're seeing, but what you might not be seeing.
Yes.
Interesting. Linda.
Well, as a dietitian, I've actually gone through, this is my third food guide, so I've seen it change. And I can say that the last food guide, that when I was dealing with patients, they didn't know what the numbers meant. They didn't understand them. So I'm really glad that they're off the front page. So that my first initial was, yes, I like this. And I really like that half your plate should be vegetables and fruit. My little concern is that I always say half your plate should be vegetables and have a fruit on the side. So that's nutritionally, I was a little concerned with that. But my overall impression was, yes, this is something people can actually use.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that too. The numbers on there before, you know, I feel like if you're this body weight and this height and this gender, then you should be eating 1.5 cups of this a day, which I thought was, you know, not practical. And also not something that you want to keep referring to. I think this is really general, and you can kind of look
to
at it.
Challenge that a little bit, though. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear what someone like a parent, and I'm looking at Jason here. I know that people who are only responsible for feeding themselves can go off of how they feel when they have a certain intake of something. But when you are making food decisions for other people, suddenly numbers become something you lean on.
That's an interesting point. I'll start off by first saying, when I saw the food guide, I was like, oh, okay, here we go. Here's an interesting new guide. Let's have a look at it. Okay, it's a photo. And I flipped the page, or flipped the webpage, and I expected to see about 100 different exact templates of this, but designed for different lifestyles and different cultures and different people. But then there wasn't. So so I said, okay, so this is now what we're dealing with. Yeah, definitely lots of brightly colored fruits and vegetables. Now I'm going to have one hell of a time convincing my kids that this is now how they're supposed to eat.
Right. And what happens when what happens in that entire part of the year, especially for people like us who live in this particular climate, where none of these particular examples of fruits and vegetables are in season.
And that's reality right now.
Absolutely.
I was actually tearing my hair out of the supermarket a couple of days ago, just for that very, very same reason. There's nothing on the shelves right now that you can find that's grown in Canada, even in greenhouses. Mm-hmm. And what upsets me even more than that is on most supermarket shelves, things are packaged in these shiny plastic bags and styrofoam containers, pre-sort of counted out green beans and broccoli stems and cauliflower stems, pre-cut mushrooms ready to go. So for me, it's more of a discussion on the waste that we're looking at with plastic in supermarkets. But not to mention
how expensive off-season produce is too. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's, you know, I think when things are in season and fresh, you can definitely buy them a lot cheaper. So to expect everybody to eat half of their food being fruits and vegetables when they're not necessarily at their prime, it could also be very costly.
I want to jump on that before we go too far on tangent. I promise I'll bring it back. I don't like the words expensive and cheaper when talking about produce. I think that we should be starting to talk more on a discussion of the food value chain and the entire food system and what true food costs are, and without disclaiming and discrediting people that are food insecure. So what I'd like to see more on a food guide and maybe more discussion on is the accessibility of fresh and nutritious food. And we need to take the word fresh into consideration, because nothing is wrong with a frozen bag of vegetables that have been properly frozen at the right time in season, or a canned or preserved jarred item as well.
Or dried or some form of preserved foods, absolutely. What about, so I originally looked at this and I said, okay, that's great. Does that represent a daily intake of food? Mm-hmm. Or is that representing what your food should be looking like at every meal?
Right.
And I think that's why, for me, I wish they still had a page that went over portion sizes and servings, or something for professionals to look at. Because I know all the culinary students, the day after this came out, they're like, we don't know how to put a portion down now. What do we do? Mm-hmm. And so I wish that was still here. Mm-hmm. And if I could speak to the food insecurity, there is a section on the website that does talk about that and tips for how to get healthier food, about the freezing. And however, if you're very low income, it's a totally different issue, and it's going to be very, very difficult, and you'd need extra assistance. But they did talk about that as well on the website, so that was good, talking about the good food box and ways that people can get fruits and vegetables.
So, yeah, we've talked about sort of initial thoughts on this, and it's kind of leading into sort of the next point or one of the other discussions about the food guide. To me, it seems highly politicized.
Yeah.
Would we agree on that? On the one hand, we have a huge outcry from the dairy industry, because dairy has effectively been removed as an actual section of the guide and mixed in with the protein section, as well as proteins have been cut down to a quarter of a plate. And of that quarter of a plate, we're looking at maybe
a third, if even that.
Yeah, maybe a third of that of meat protein. So a lot more plant-based proteins here. What are our thoughts on that? Is it something we like, something we dislike? What are your concerns?
I think that it's kind of, there's a lot of people who don't eat meat. You know, there's a lot of people who choose not to for whatever reason, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that by not having a huge section that's called meat and alternatives, it's a lot more inclusive to the people who aren't eating meat.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, if you flip through the webpage as well and kind of click around, under the protein section, there is meat. It's still there. It says, you know, eat lean meats and poultry. So I think that it's not the Canada Food Guide's job to advertise for the meat industry. And I feel like if they want to advertise for themselves, they can, you know. So, and same with dairy. There's also a lot of people who don't eat dairy or have dairy allergies or sensitivities, you know. So I think
My concern with that is I agree. I totally agree that we need a protein group and not a milk group and a meat group. However, because this was so drastic, I wish they'd put in another line. Where do you get calcium from? Because calcium is found in leafy greens, and many Canadians don't eat leafy greens. So where are they going to get that from? Mm-hmm. And knowing where do we get vitamin D from? Because of this drastic change, that's what I felt that was missing. And in terms of Canada, about 90% actually eat meat, and it's only about 10 to 12% that are actually vegetarians. However, 25% of Canadians are trying to reduce meat. So I think that that it's good they now have that much more variety there and not just focus on the meat.
And I guess the reason I brought up the point of it being highly politicized is the fact that it's, one of my thoughts on the food guide seems to be, it's very environmentally focused, even in undertones. They're like, Mina, I know you're going to call me on this one.
But I'm going to call this hard, Jason.
Yeah, so I'm finding some very environmentally friendly undertones in the food guide. Because of the reduction of the amount of meat that's on there, we're being told by the Food Agricultural Organization of the United Nations that meat-based agriculture, big meat, is using up more resources than all the planes, trains, and automobiles in the world, contributing to more greenhouse gases. We have a serious problem with the amount of meat that we consume as a world. So I see that as an environmentally strong move on the part of the food guide. And Linda, maybe you can just jump in right before Mina tears me down. What is the nutritional value of having less meat-based protein in our diets?
Well, my biggest concern is iron intake, and iron in plant foods is not as well absorbed, and some of the high iron foods people don't eat, so they don't like cooked spinach and they don't like beans and nuts, and so I'm a little concerned about their iron intake, which can lead to anemia and loss of energy. I'm concerned about protein. I actually did my PhD in protein research, and I know I'm concerned about protein, and we know that meat has much more protein than all the other food groups, so I'm a little concerned over time we're gonna see some issues.
So eat more spinach, eat more beans, is what you're saying.
I'm saying that, yeah.
Now, Mina, what did you have to say there?
My issue essentially is on almost like a symbolic level, where I see an image and I understand that there are, as you say, you use the word political, and I think a lot can go into forming a political angle. I think there are many decisions in producing an image like this that are significant. This is a plate, right? Like, we're no longer using abstract imagery like a rainbow, right? No one eats off of a rainbow. Everyone immediately understands that there's interpretive work involved in deciphering an image like a rainbow. Whereas a plate is something that's a lot more concrete and it's a lot more literal. It connects to ways that we eat on a daily basis. Now, my kind of comment vis-a-vis your discussion of this environmental angle is, what happens if we interpret this more literally? Because the symbolism seems to be leaning in that direction, right? If someone were to interpret this kind of literally, right now we're, you know, early February in Toronto. And if I were to put
30
deep freeze, and I shop at a farmer's market, and I'm very familiar with what version of each of these food groups is available to us if we are shopping in that in that particular way. My partner and I have had no fruits in our apartments other than apples for a long time, and chances are that's not going to change for another few months at least. So if you were to interpret this literally and eat tomorrow, go out and eat most of what's on here, I'm seeing tomatoes, I'm seeing bell pepper, there's blueberries, strawberries, quinoa, right? The almonds, so let's say there's no milk here. So if you were to drink a cup of almond milk, like, what are we, environmentally speaking, how much carbon emission is going to go into getting this exact static image to my household, even if money was not an issue?
So great points there. Almonds, we know almonds use a lot of water.
And they're coming here from California.
Yeah, California's under a drought right now. We also see quinoa in there. Quinoa is not native to Canada. That comes from the Andes, and we know that quinoa is a politicized food as well,
food
too,
right,
because
now
we're removing the food security of indigenous peoples in South America so that we can feed our need for a superfood of quinoa. So definitely some things on there that
Just a quick thing before I hand it over to probably Wendy, is that my final criticism, skepticism about this kind of image is the visual variety that it seems to recommend we have in our food, which right now, like one of the most responsible plates of food that you can put together in the part of the world that we're from will be pretty much all beige. Yeah. And if we don't find a way to make that palatable and desirable to ourselves, like if turnips and beets don't seem as legitimate and variegated and interesting to us as three colors of bell pepper, we're making some environmentally questionable decisions, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not necessarily visualized here in this, you know, colorful plate of delicious things from California.
Yeah.
And it's not really talked about when you go further into the guide. I looked through it and I was looking at trying to find any information about like buying local or any information about environmental impacts about buying shipped in produce. Mm-hmm. And there's really, I think someone told me that there was a mention of it, but I couldn't find it myself. So. I mean,
yeah. I definitely agree 100% with everything Nina says. I also started, like I said earlier, I like to take apart things that I initially start with positives. And it's beautiful. It's great. It's a plate. But as soon as I have discussions with people or my students about it, and I give them a few seconds to see what I'm trying to show them, it's exactly that. It's that a third of my students don't eat peppers, or they don't have strawberries in their fridge, or they don't like carrots. And right away,
you're doing something right.
I ask them what they should eat as an alternative in Canada as a citizen right now, a resident of Toronto. And they can't think of an alternative because they're stuck on this plate. Mm-hmm. So it's not that they don't have the creativity or ability to see what's available in Ontario. It's that this plate gets you stuck. And unless you're someone who likes to be skeptical or critically thinking or opposing the norm, we're going to get a mass amount of people in Canada who, by the way, let's not forget all the immigrants who would love to just start not assimilating, no, but adapting their lifestyle a little bit more to Canadian wet lifestyle. And this is a great start. And what we're teaching them,
there would be an opportunity here to build a great start. Except where are all of the other interesting root vegetables? Like, where's the turnip? Where's the celeriac?
Exactly.
Where's, you know, all the things that you can actually get here?
All of that is missing. And that's what frustrates me about it. I think that when we say the things I like the most about it, like I said earlier, are the words. Have plenty of vegetables and fruits. But immediately people jump to fresh. People don't, why is there not a single word there that says, though, preserved, pickled, mm-hmm. dried, anything? And I do know that you guys keep saying throughout the website, there is more information. But unfortunately, because we're having a discussion on it, we've pulled it apart.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are not are going to stick this on their fridge
mm-hmm.
and forget about it.
Right. Are they going to promptly forget about it
mm-hmm.
and just use this as a guide?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my concerns, Dahlia, just in a sec there, one of my concerns is with this, and we sort of touched on it before, is the amount of food that we should be eating.
Mm-hmm.
There really is no guide as to how many fruits and vegetables, how much protein you should be having at every meal. So,
Sure. I just wanted to say about the diversity of like the fruits and vegetables that we're not seeing on the plate. I think that it's actually pretty difficult to know what is in season anyway. You know what
mm-hmm.
I mean? Like the food guide doesn't help at all when you first look at the plate, but also I find that it's difficult to know what's in season if you're not like regularly shopping at fresh markets, you know? And I think that maybe it would be helpful if they had like, you know, a plate for each season to tell you what to eat in each season, you know,
which actually
winter, spring,
wouldn't
summer,
be
fall.
Impossible
yeah.
at all, considering the technology and the visual, you know, capacity that we have to put these images together.
Mm-hmm.
You could easily have clicked through four samples of this plate. And I think it could have been a less cluttered, less symbolic and more
right.
helpful image in the end. And I think connecting back a little bit to what Wendy was saying about the words, I think I completely agree that the words are a segue to optimism, but at the same time, they signal a kind of problematic, like a lost opportunity
sure.
where with words you can say things like, take the time to find out about more vegetables, for
example. So on the one hand, we've ostracized the Canadian dairy farmers, we've ostracized the Canadian meat producers, and we've also ostracized the Canadian vegetable producers.
Absolutely, we have.
Foodland Ontario is not in here. Oh, Linda?
I just want to play devil's advocate for a little bit, because Toronto is not all of Canada. And when I worked with patients, I didn't work in Toronto. I worked in an area where they had, I had never heard of a celeriac. Like, that's just something we never use.
So where was it?
This is Hamilton. It's an hour away. Like, I had never heard of it. I came here because this is what's on the food guide here is what people ate. And also, if it's local in Ontario, it might not be local in British Columbia. And like, that's depending on season. So how would you know how to build that plate? Would you have one for the
But that's
West?
Where the words come in handy, right? Yeah. Like, where you can fix that as in rhetoric, in explaining to people constantly that this is a sample and that it needs to be interpreted.
Well,
I don't find that here.
Find
this for your area.
I thought there was going to be an infographic in the page behind it where it says, like, okay, this little white circular thing, what is that? Is that milk? Is it yogurt? Is it kefir?
I
found myself trying to figure out one of these things. And if this is not, as we all know, Canada is a multicultural, diverse country. Some of those things people might not be very familiar with.
For sure. I can definitely name people who wouldn't know that that's a cube of tofu.
Yeah.
That could look like anything. That could look like paneer to you if you're Indian.
I thought that was paneer.
Yeah. It could be a roasted cube of chicken.
For sure.
That's true. Also, on the contrary of having a lot of words, I kind of do like how it says eat protein foods, you know, just plain and simple, and have plenty of vegetables and fruits. And it doesn't necessarily like say eat, you know, this broccoli or these peas here. It just says have plenty of fruits and vegetables. So when you do look at it, eat protein foods, make water your choice, and choose whole grain. You know, I kind of think... Mm-hmm. If you are sort of reading the words, I think they want you to sort of interpret them in the way that you're saying you wish it was interpreted. But I understand what you mean about how the visual is a little bit misleading.
But I think something to remember is what you can aspire to, which is always higher and better.
Right.
And I think, you know, sure, this is not bad to say that, you know, eat plenty of vegetables and fruits. But I think you have an opportunity there to go a little further and remind people.
Eat local.
You know, or, you know.
Vegetables and fruits.
Yeah, what else can you get in
there?
Something that I think could have been an interesting challenge. I don't see it necessarily taken on here.
Right.
It's true. What I wanted to actually bring it back to was you had mentioned, Linda, that your focus, but your fear was on lack of vitamins and minerals, et cetera. And as much as the old food guide was confusing in portion size, I remember being a student in one of my very first nutrition classes and literally not doing well because I was overwhelmed in just learning new words, minerals, and understanding what a fatty acid was to an omega-3. And yet, fundamentally, that's how we should be building our plates, is what our individual body needs. Not how large this plate is, how many times you eat the size of plate, but actually some individuals don't need this size of plate and some need way more because they're athletes, etc. So really, in a plate like this, asking you as a dietitian, is there another more visual way where we take it away from actually food items, but actually breaking it down, like you say, iron, and then put images of spinach and images of beef and images of other protein options.
And since we have all of this technology, maybe when you hover your cursor over spinach, you know, a lemon can show up and tell you that, why you need vitamin C to absorb certain things. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the idea of complementary nutrients can be actually, you know, why convey less information when you have the ability to convey more. And I understand there's a point to be made for clarity, but if you reach so far into clarity that you miss an opportunity to communicate vital information, I'm not sure if you're just kind of dumbing down your conversation.
That's what I mean. Is there a way, without saying dumbing down and clarifying, in a singular plate, the same way you'd be able to reiterate to me the importance of not just protein, but of iron, of vitamin C, of sodium, etc., in the same way that they've done it here in the food guide? Can it be done on a plate?
I think that would be very difficult simply because there are so many nutrients.
Right.
And so how would we, we can find iron in many, you know, different foods, or we can find vitamin C in different foods. And like, calcium. How do we do that? Yeah. So I only brought up the calcium one because it was such a big change. Yeah. But yeah, but I'm open to think about it for sure, because
How neat would it be if, for example, the online version of this guide gave you an ability to put in your concerns? So let's say that you knew that you were iron deficient, and if you told the guide to isolate for that. Like, we know that from a programming perspective, that's highly doable.
Yeah.
That you can put a filter on something. Mm-hmm. So
I think the argument coming from the government and coming from Health Canada is that for that sort of specific information, you should be having a discussion whether we're the registered dietitian.
That was my thought.
Mm-hmm. Right? It does say that, actually.
Yeah. Because it does, like, I love your point, Mina. It does. There is a lot of information that the guide does not have, but it does direct you into many different areas where you can get more information.
Right.
I guess my biggest concern is how distilled it's become.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, it's just this very simple,
as a document.
Yeah,
as a static document.
Yeah, it's a simple plate with multiple things on the plate. Designed to show people how they should be eating.
Mm-hmm.
I love the fact that there's just water there. There's no tea.
Love
there's no coffee.
Too, yeah.
There's no
orange juice. Yeah.
Well, and a huge difference that we haven't discussed yet comparatively is that the rainbow had many packages on it.
Mm-hmm. Lots of packages.
And
yeah.
This is a completely unpackaged view of what you should be eating.
Very, very true.
Mm-hmm. You know, the first thing I did actually when I looked at this, I Googled, where can, like, what fruits and vegetables have calcium? That's the first thing I got. And then I was like, oh my God, all of them. Like,
No, not all of them.
Sorry, lots of them. A lot of them. Yeah.
Broccoli.
So I was exaggerating, sorry.
Yeah, but that's
a lot of them do, yeah.
That's amazing you did that. And will Canadians do that? Mm-hmm. Like, I know this is a home example, but my mom says, I've learned for 35 years that milk is good for you. Is it not good for you anymore? So she didn't take that step. And how do we teach Canadians to do that?
I asked my friends, who, she has a young child in school right now, and she's about my age and in her 30s, and she said, what I'm worried about now, based on this new food guide, is that the schools will stop serving milk to my child. And she's like, because remember when we used to, and we had that dinosaur sticker thing, they encourage us drinking a carton of milk a day when I was in elementary because of the food guide. And so then I reminded her, I'm like, the reason you think milk is important is because of the Canadian food guide. So now this new one is telling us it's not as important as it used to be. Does that mean it's less nutritious if your daughter's not getting milk? Or is it that the Canadian food guide has learned it's not the only way to get calcium for your child in a daily intake? And she's like, I never thought of that. I'm like, you only think milk is nutritious because the Canadian Food Guide and your institutional school instilled it in you. And now there's a new one. Maybe you'll reapproach it differently, just like the school will.
Mm-hmm.
And right away she's like, so I don't have to buy her milk. That was her first question. They do get stuck on one singular item.
But are then you going to serve these children's leafy greens?
Yeah,
no.
that's what I was going to say.
Right? And
are you going to serve them GMO soy milk?
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Or almond milk.
Or almond milk,
because
of the allergy.
Yeah.
Scenario in schools, right?
Well, I live with a 9-year-old, and she's a really picky eater. And my aunt gets her to drink milk, and that's how she gets her to get her calcium, because
her
she likes it.
And,
yeah, and her protein and vitamin D and magnesium, a bunch of things.
Yeah.
But, you know, milk is, I don't think, it's not bad for you. It's actually really good for you, and it does have a lot of nutrients in it. But you can also find those nutrients in plenty of other things, too.
Yeah.
So it's not...
Except from the environmental standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
If you're trying to be less impactful in the environment, milk is one of the causes.
I think actually the wording of that is a good segue to what's good for you and what's bad for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what does something have to be for us to say that it's bad for you? Because I can definitely imagine some very, strong arguments against the notion that milk, we're not talking about organic milk here.
Mm-hmm.
When you say milk, you have to be prepared for it to mean conventional milk.
Yeah,
the stuff that's $2.99
in
bags,
right.
You know, that comes in a plastic bag that's inside another plastic bag. This
mm-hmm.
is all a
yeah.
part of what's what that implies, right? It's mm-hmm. a one syllable word, but it has a lot of meaning in it.
Right.
What is it? What does something have to do for us to admit that it's bad for you?
Right. Because if we go back to this page, the biggest font words next to under the plate says healthy eating is more than the foods you eat. And then it follows with eat well and live well. So we're focusing it on health, but at the same time, it's telling us to live well. How do we talk about food without talking about the environment now and the earth that we live on and every other species that we share this ecosystem with? So it sort of prefaces it there again. Like you said, we're hinting on next level critical thinking, but at the same time, how many people jump from eat well, live well to I'm going to drink milk that's treated properly, raised properly, minimal impact, small
glass
farm,
bottle.
Glass bottle. How many of us jump there? Antibiotic-free, hormone, et cetera, et cetera. How many of us jump from eat well to live well in that stance?
Well, certainly can everybody afford that, though, too? Yeah. You know, can everybody afford that? Like my, you know, yeah. if that's like the only 100%. Source of, like the largest source of calcium that my 9-year-old cousin is intaking, it's really easy for... You know, I think it's really easy for a lot of parents to, mm-hmm. you know, buy those $2 bags of milk, you know. So I know it's unfortunate and it is, but I think.
But do you think that, do you put together a guide to follow people's already established habits, or do you put together a guide to hope to challenge those habits?
I just think that this guide is what I like about it is that it's inclusive to all people, and it's inclusive to people with different budgets, and it's inclusive to just a general mass of people. And I think that dairy is not on there because it is, I mean a little bit, but I think that there's not a dairy category because all people can't drink milk or don't drink milk, you know, so or don't sorry eat dairy, you know. So
if we're going to talk about being all inclusive and mm-hmm. caring about all economic levels of people in Canada and worry about their welfare, let's talk about all of the grains there, but let's go back to the dairy. So we're just okay with displacing the income of all dairy and cattle farmers that have been conventionally practicing and not worry about their children and their income livelihood. Mm-hmm. We have made tough choices on this plate already at the expense of other people's income. So if we're going to push that, we can ask for something else.
Mm-hmm. Or you can say, you know, so you can still eat meat and drink dairy, eat less of it, mm-hmm. and eat from better
yeah,
producers.
That's right, yeah.
Right? So buy right. your dairy from local producers. Buy your cheese from small dairies like Monforte Dairy.
Which brings us kind of to the second page of this document, right? Mm-hmm. Like not the image, but yeah. the instructions, right. the sort of cultural guidelines yeah. of this food guide. What does it say and what does it leave out?
Yeah.
I think that's where you are right now.
Well, we're really close to that point. We've talked about food security. We've talked about Toronto not having access to the food that it needs. We talked a little bit about food sovereignty and this guide not representing one of the 200 different distinct cultures that we have in this country. We just started talking about affordability, and Dahlia, you said you found this to be quite affordable. One of the people that we sort of refer to as our food heroes, Nick Saul from Community Food Centers Canada, in Maclean's magazine said that 13% of Canadians, 13% of Canadians are don't have adequate food to eat. So from the perspective of this food guide, showing a lot of fresh vegetables, a lot of grains, not a lot of meat, is it truly affordable? That kind of is the biggest thing that worries me with this food guide. And I mm-hmm. think I have a feeling that the food guide is a stepping stone towards a broader Canadian food policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
Like
that's how I feel
about
it.
A few undertones in there, removing dairy, removing meat, more highlight on vegetable, plant-based proteins. I'm not seeing as much local focus as I'd like there to be, but I feel like we're heading in that direction. One of the quotes that's in the food guide says, be aware of food marketing. And that statement alone kind of just leads you to think, what does that mean? Be aware mm-hmm. of food marketing. But when you sort of dig deeper into food marketing, then that sort of brings to light what they're actually talking about. So I guess the question that I'm coming to at this point is, should that have been in the front page? Before, like, this is our food guide. Should there have been some sort of a classification beforehand saying, here's how food should be classified. Be aware of food marketing. And specifically, be aware of food marketing that markets ultra-processed foods.
I like that you mentioned food policy, because I feel like this food guide is, it's meant to just be, like, I think, just a general basic guide. But I think it is the start of a discussion about a food policy in Canada. And I think that, Nina, as you were saying, like, it could use more words, you know, it definitely could use more words. And there's definitely a lot of things about where we're getting our food and affordability and food sovereignty, access, you know, access to food. And I think that a food policy would be the solution to the things that I think we all sort of agree are missing on the food guide. You know, and I think there is a lot of advocacy for a food policy in Canada. And I don't think that this is a proper, we can't look at this food guide as our food policy, but we need to maybe think about developing a food policy that includes all these missing things.
If this is a stepping stone toward developing a food policy, I can find it worrisome as well. Because I find that if that is the case, if this is some kind of gateway conversation to developing a more concise, more effective food policy that's going to deliver us into the now kind of toward the, you know, 2020s, it is kind of alarming that nothing is mentioned about the type of farming that will bring whatever is on this plate on this plate.
Yeah.
The fact that there's not a single word on here.
I think buried deep down inside somewhere, I came across one mention of GMO foods.
Yeah, buried. Somebody told me there was. I couldn't find it.
On the surface level. You know, we're being told to beware of marketing.
Let's take a break right there, folks, and we'll come right back as we discuss more about the Canada Food Guide. Welcome back, everyone, to our discussion on Canada's new food guide. We have Jamila here joining us right now, another student from George Brown. Jamila, would you like to say hi and introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Jamila, and I was born in Uzbekistan. And I'm a culinary student right now at the George Brown College. Current immigrant, and also very curious about the food guide and sustainability in Canada.
Fantastic. Thank Welcome. You so much. So we were having a great discussion before we took a quick break. And we thought we'd lead the next sort of discussion into, from a sustainable perspective, how does the food guide look at George Brown Chef School, or the future of a chef school? Like, what does this food guide look for you as, and we have a number of former students in the room with us, as well as current students right now. So, Dahlia, would you like to start off with that?
So I just found out that that the sustainability course at George Brown is brand new this year, and I was
the
a little bit
sustainable chef.
The sustainable chef, yeah, and I was very surprised by that, because I think that talking about sustainability and where we're actually sourcing our food, especially for aspiring chefs, I think it's really important. I think that. Looking around at my peers and the people that I go to school with, I feel like sustainability is not necessarily a thing that is talked about or cared about, maybe. And I think it's just because a lot of people are not educated on how to source your food sustainably or ethically even. But I think, you know, kind of looking at food from an aspiring chef's point of view is sort of looking for fresh ingredients and like the best quality or whatever, but we're not looking about where we're buying it from and who we're buying it from and what the consequences of buying non-seasonal produce are. And so I think that that's something about the Canada Food Guide that I feel is a little bit lacking, but I feel like is something that definitely needs to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I guess I'm wondering, as I look at that plate, it really is not meat protein focused. It's really plant-based, right?
Mm, yes.
And the curriculum that we teach, all fantastic, wonderful skills, how is this going to influence our curriculum? If we're saying this is what we should eat, how does that relate back to the skills that we're teaching and the product that we're using? Jamila, you're smiling.
You look like you have something to say.
Well, that's a very good point, because
in the classical French cuisine that we learn right now in a George Brown, there is no way you can be healthy. There's lots of butter. There's lots of fat. There's lots of other sub-products and derivatives that we use, including animal fat that can be base of most of the stocks and sauces. If you look at the whole perspective of the French cuisine, of course, it has changed over the time. But the classical way which Escoffier taught since the dawn of the French cuisine is still there. It doesn't necessarily support the new requirements of the food guide. And if we want to do that, we need to include that in our recipes that are now currently in George Brown that I haven't seen so far. Maybe I'm mistaken, but maybe in culinary management
there was
they
a
do.
Rebirth, I think, in the 70s with the onset of Nouveau Cuisine. But yeah, that's true. I think what we're seeing now as compared to then, people were looking to be healthier back in the 70s and 80s when Nouveau Cuisine sort of came about and we saw less stock-based and roux-based sauces and more vegetable-based and more nages. What we're seeing now is people want to be healthy, but we also want to educate people that it's just not okay anymore to be consuming as much meat as we do.
Well, look at the climate, you know, we just had a deep freeze and now it was like minus 30 and now it's 7 degrees. And in Australia, like, it's so hot that bats are dying, you know, they're just having a crazy heat wave right now too. So we have to look at that and think about, what is our contribution and like, what are we doing and what can we change about it? And a lot of it is directly related to what we eat.
So for me, speaking about our culinary curriculum, and fundamentally, before we talk about the food guide, our role, hopefully, is to still train and educate chefs or future cooks, right? And so the idea is, in order for us to even go past what we should teach them in ideas of protein, we can't assume and send out cooks that don't know how to do full animal butchery. We can't send them off and only educate them on old, whatever you want to call them, antiquated French culinary fundamentals when we keep focusing back on local and Ontario. So the idea is, how do we integrate whole animal without reneging the Canadian Food Guide to eat less meat? And
Where is that compromise?
I think that actually makes me see something that I may have seen but hadn't articulated to myself before, which is that the sort of manicured way in which these foods show up on this symbolic plate, it can be kind of problematic when you think about, you know, the perspective of a chef, like where, you know, you've got these cubes that we said before, they could be tofu or they could be chicken or they could be paneer, but, you know, you've got this like piece of sliced white meat, it looks like it's kind of the breast of something, and you know, the beef that appears
perfect
in that
juice.
Perfect way,
yeah.
Right, like where's the fish bone, where's the fish head, I want to know, you know, where's the liver, where's the where are the hooves, like this kind of eat, you know, if you are going to put in if you are going to put in statements that are going to say choose whole grain foods, why not say choose whole foods, period, right?
Oh, that's a great one. So just before we jump into Linda, eat more spinach, eat less meat, eat less dairy, but better qualities,
and
eat whole foods.
And you know, that little bit of meat could be liver. It doesn't have to be a steak.
What we're still stuck on is how do we get access for everyone, and how do we make these whole foods more affordable? But anyway, Linda.
I guess because I've worked with the general public, they wouldn't understand that. They wouldn't know what to do with it. And I think we have to start somewhere, but we gotta make changes slowly, I think. If we try to change it all at once, they're gonna be, I don't know what to do with a hoof, and they're just gonna throw the food guide out.
But do you feel that we need to write to our audience or for our audience? Like, are we trying to correct patterns or are we trying to kind of perpetuate them? I think to say that we are going to put things that people relate to, then
but they're still healthy things.
I think we can't go, I agree with you, Mina, but we can't actually design a food guide at this moment to hopefully perpetuate change without government and all stakeholders involved. Mm-hmm. Like, this sounds like laws and regulations will go into it as well to get a democracy of some sort of majority going with this way of eating whole animal or just trying to get some to eat a little bit of protein.
I agree with you, yeah. But I wonder if maybe a year ago, the same thing could have been said about the dairy thing, right? Yeah. But you know, some people may have said, I agree with you, but there's no way that we can just, you know, go ahead and scrap this whole, and yet we see that, you know, some of these paradigm shifts are possible.
An underlying issue with dairy in itself is we're producing way more dairy than we need to, mm-hmm. right? And our cows are being fed food that they're not supposed to eat to create more dairy than we need. The United mm-hmm. States creates more dairy than it needs, and they're looking for places to dump their dairy. This was one of the big issues that happened in the U.S., the USMCA. Our food system is broken to the point where we are creating more food than we need. We're wasting it, mm-hmm. right? So it came out 3 weeks ago, just before the food guide did, that where we thought that 30% mm-hmm. of the food that was created in Canada was wasted. We're looking closer to 56% of the food that is created in Canada goes into the trash can.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking as well. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the food industry, like the meat industry. You can buy very easily a steak or a chicken breast or chicken thighs or whatever. Everything's like separated, you know. And I think that kind of goes back to our food system and how is our food system maybe not correlating to how we can eat more sustainably. Like when you go to the grocery store, why is it so hard to maybe buy like, you know, a big portion of an animal and then kind of try to utilize that animal rather than going and buying, you know, your chicken thighs and
your perfect steak.
Yeah, your perfect whatever, this and this. There's a lot of waste there. And I think it's just been like this for a very long time. And the industry is sort of, the system is sort of made this the way to do things that it's really difficult to just try to start educating people and to actually not even people, but the food system in the beginning to start, you know, selling products that can be utilized.
I think the food system, like if you're seeing chicken breasts and chicken legs in one store, you're not seeing the chicken feet in that store. They're either being sold in a different store or they're being exported to another company or country, or they're used to mm-hmm. make stocks. I don't think the food system is broken from that perspective. I don't think that the waste is coming from there. I think where the waste is coming from is in food processing facilities where broccoli stalks might not be used. They might be thrown out. If an apple has a bruise on it, rather than it be reduced and sold, it's thrown into the garbage. We've moved past this position of having food that is nutritious and delicious, mm-hmm. but we're looking for food that's all beautiful.
I've studied agriculture in Europe. So agriculture has a definition, distinct, uniform, and standard. A priori, all the food production starts from the field where all the produce have been selected according to certain parameters where all the food waste starts initially, right? Mm-hmm. Then the second step is a retailer that, for example, British Consortium Retailer organization sets very strict requirements to selecting produce in a certain way. And that should look concerned. If it's not looking the same way, as Jason, you said, it has been discarded, mm-hmm. right? That's one way of doing things. But coming back to the food guide in Canada, I was trying to find the studies about the stakeholders that has been involved into those interviewing processes. And I was just wondering, who were those stakeholders? Who were those people who mm-hmm. were asked, what do you want to see in a food guide? Because mm-hmm. there is a perfectly Chinese food cookbooks that say how to eat from head to toe. Mm-hmm. There is a amazing British food cookbook with the recipes also from head to toe. Mm-hmm. And if you go to, there is a nuclear site that mm-hmm. has been built in the 60s in Canada, close to Ottawa that even has this yes. little cookbook mm-hmm. that you can find that say how to correctly eat during World War II mm-hmm. in Canada. Yeah. And I was just wondering, okay, so if those were stakeholders, how diverse they were, what kind of nationalities were involved, what kind of backgrounds were involved. Mm-hmm. And maybe from that perspective, we can judge, were there enough people involved who would advise on yeah. more options to be included?
Mm-hmm. And I think that leads us back to this discussion of food policy for Canada. How do we create this food policy for Canada that's inclusive of everyone and respects everyone's dignity and food sovereignty and food security? So one of the statements that I had made earlier was that I think this food guide is a stepping stone towards it. I like to hope so. Anyway.
Yeah, towards a food policy.
I'm not sure if it is or not. Linda, what did you think about the question in respect to a chef school and this current food guide?
Well, I think my concern is knowing what portions to put on the plate. Mm-hmm. And so that when I went to class, as I was saying, the next day, people were like, I don't know what to do with this. How do we put food on the plate anymore? And I kept saying, okay, go back to the old food guide so you know how to make a portion for it. Because the very next day, one of the questions was, what's a portion of vegetables?
I love that, actually. Mm-hmm. I think from the perspective of you know, plate designed, I mean conceptualizing what to serve as a serving of, as a plate of food, as a chef especially, I love this because I think for a while now, a lot of us, you know, eating even in finer dining destinations, we've noticed that vegetables are occupying a much more central preoccupation for the chef recently. And we know about a lot of our chef heroes are now people who don't just have direct relationships with vegetable farms, they have them. Mm-hmm. Their restaurants are being pulled closer and closer to these places. And so I think, you know, when I imagine that this kind of statement can free us from that static notion of the shank in the center of the plate with some, you know, garnish of a broccoli. Like, I think if you were to actually apply this ratio to a plate of restaurant food, you come up with something that I personally would love eating a lot more. Mm-hmm. And I think it corresponds to the food that's already being made at some of my favorite restaurants. Mm-hmm. I know that that's kind of a self-centered pleasure, but I think, you know, where it relates to the work of being a chef, I find this comforting.
So I had a student make a point that when we start talking about food sovereignty and food security, in terms of North America, mm-hmm. if we want to be food secure, we're focusing on a lot of fish, a lot of dairy, a lot of meat, a lot of grains, and a lot of pulses. Right. So if we look at the underlying reality of the of what we grow and what we produce in this country, in terms of being food secure, that's one strong argument that can be made there. So how do you compare that to this food guide?
It's definitely no bell peppers in what you just mentioned.
Very true. No quinoa either.
Yeah, it's true.
No mention about GMOs in this food guide. How do we feel about that?
Oh, we don't feel good.
We don't feel good about it at all.
So beware of marketing. Beware of marketing, no mention about transparency, although do read food labels is in there, but no sort of discussion about genetically modified.
More labeling. That kind of goes, I was just going to say that as well. What about food labeling? Mm-hmm. And, you know, genetically modified food does not have to be labeled in Canada. So, you know, I personally feel like it's up to the consumer. It should be up to the consumer to decide on if they want to, you know, if they want to be eating food that has been genetically modified.
So one of the things that I think we all agree on with the food guide is be aware of marketing, be aware of ultra processed foods. And we all notice on that food guide, there's no packaged food on there, which is fantastic.
Yeah, we didn't really talk about that. Yeah.
And one of the other awesome things about the food guide is it promotes people eating together more. Cooking more, using more whole foods, eating together more. I just wanted to think, sort of final thoughts. How do you feel about that being included in a food guide for Canada? How important is that for us?
I think it's wonderful, and I'm super elated that is actually included in the food guide. I just think that food is about recognizing everybody that's participating in it. It's not only nourishing to your stomach, but it's to your heart or your mood, your emotions. And when it's shared, sat down together, conversations happen, realizations happen, how you eat, how much you eat, how slow you eat, because now it's in between conversation. It affects everything in a nutritional aspect to an emotional aspect. And when you enjoy a meal, conversation sparks. Where it came from, who grew it, what season it was, how you made it, recipes, traditions, stories. That is what ties people to food again. And if we don't reconnect humans, like I mentioned, back to food, we're at risk of breaking another food system. So I think the fact that we should be eating together is in the food guide. I'm excited. And that's where I want to leave this discussion from me on.
Wendy Ma. Linda, thoughts?
I think it encourages people to look at people that are eating alone. And why are they eating alone? And you know, they've lost a spouse. They're living in poverty and they don't have a family. Like, so invite your neighbor over. Let's put Canadians together to enjoy food and enjoy the culture of eating.
Awesome. I agree. I think it's important to kind of look at the missing part of that. Not necessarily as something that the food guide leaves out, but that maybe it brings our attention to, not just that it's great to eat together, but also that it's not great to not have that option. The same way that we can all agree that in an ideal situation, everyone should have access to the ideal version of what should be on our plate. I think that ideal extends off the plate. And it's great that what is kind of has been seen as peripheral to what lands on our plate is now included in our food guide. I think that's definitely a step in the right direction.
I noticed that it was actually a large chunk on the website about eating together. And then they also have this other section that says eat with your children, or like teach your children. And it's also about being mindful about your food. And it also, I think, I really feel like it is connecting us to our food, and it's trying to just kind of say, educate yourself about food and, you know, educate others and, you know, kind of make food a part of your life. I say to my picky 9-year-old cousin all the time, I say, food is such a beautiful part of life. Like, why don't you love, you know, to eat food? I love eating food with you. And I, you know, I love eating food with my friends. And so I think, I really like that they put that in there. And I think it's really important as well.
Delia, thank you. Julia.
Well, eating together is actually not a new thing for me, because I grew up in a community type based place, and where I came from, eating together was obligatory. Actually, sharing with neighbors in times of food crisis was obligatory because you didn't have any monetary value of things. It was just a barter because of the shortage of certain items that we didn't have, and exchange with our neighbors just actually brought us together. And we would have sort of like festivals where we would put up the big tables and all people and our family and friends and neighbors would sit together. And this is the same thing I've seen in Europe many, many times, especially in Italy, where they like to do this, especially in the South. If you go there, you're going to be a guest at any single party. And this is what was done by my parents, by my grandparents. And I would just like to continue this tradition no matter where I'm going to end up myself.
Yeah,
beautiful.
A real sense of community, I think, as well, too. And it's important, Daly, you brought it up. Kids, you know, a lot of people today are working in silos. They're spending a lot of time with their face down on computers or watching TV. And for mental health, I think it's important, as well as nutrition, for us all to sit down and enjoy a communal meal together. And Linda, I think you made a great point there, too. That people, they might have lost a spouse or might not have a home. So it's important that we share food with each other. So maybe as a final goodbye to all the chef school students out there, if you're sitting down for lunch at the cafe or at the chef school or conviviality, see someone sitting alone, ask them if you can sit next to them and start up a conversation. My name is Jason Innes. We have have Wendy Ma, we have Delia Dupree, we have Zamelia Sharapova, we have Mina Shakarbani, and we have Linda Gillis here today. Thank you all for sharing that wonderful afternoon with us, and have a fantastic day.